Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you are welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali. Distinguished guests are David Onserio Monda, Professor of Political Science at the City University of New York, and Nyaka Lagoke, Assistant Professor of History and Pan-African Studies at Lincoln University. First of all, gentlemen, to be honest with you, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you again on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much for having us, Shaka.
Thanks again, Shaka, for the opportunity.
You're most welcome, Ndugu brothers. First of all, David, you are, of course, an expert probably on this issue that we are talking about, the constitutional term limits. What exactly does that mean? What is the importance, first and foremost, of constitutional term limits?
I think that basically means that whoever holds office cannot hold that particular office, whether it's president or prime minister, forever. There has to be a period of time when they are in office, and then they have to seek a mandate from the people on whether they can continue in that job or whether they need to leave. And that mandate, usually in some countries, it's 4 years, and then you have to seek a mandate from the people, or 5 years or 7 years. It depends on the term. But the idea with term limits is you cannot continue to rule forever. And the idea with that, for example, in the context of the United States, is that George Washington didn't want to become a king because he was asked to run for a third term and a fourth term, and he refused. And the idea with the context of the U.S. was that we wanted to have term limits when, whether you're an excellent president, you get to give someone else a chance. And the last part of that, Shaka, is term limits also allow for the destruction of what we call these cronies, these crony networks, whereby if someone has been in office too long, they get lazy, they're not always in touch with the people's needs, but also those around them tend to look for their own personal interests above national interests. So that's the general idea of term limits. You want to limit how long someone will be in office.
Now, you talk about how, when it came to the United States, the founding father of the United States, the great General George Washington, his supporters wanted him to be a king, and he declined. What is the difference between a president of a republic and a monarchy, a king or a queen?
So two main distinctions there. A king, a monarchy, is established through bloodlines, through familial lines, through succession. Whereas in a republic, you have an individual who's in what we call a social contract. In other words, the people give up some of their powers into a president or an executive. And after a period of time, that individual has to be held accountable to the people through elections. The other part of the difference between a monarchy and a republic is that people hold sovereign power in a republic. So they ultimately have the choice on whether they want the leader to continue or not. In a monarchy, it's a rule by and for one. So basically the king or the queen or the prince or princess decides what rights the people will have, when they will or will not leave power, and who will succeed them. That is not the case in a republic. The people have a sovereign choice, and they do that usually through elections or through plebiscites, through people power.
Interesting. Nyaka, what about you?
Well, yes. David gave a nice overview, and then I'm not going to repeat what he said about the differences between a monarchy and a republic. The only thing that I wanted to add is that the good thing about a presidential term limits is that it gives the possibility, you know, to see democratic changes in the society. And then in the light of what we saw or we experienced in Africa with those leaders in the aftermath of African independence who stayed in power for a very long time. For instance, in Ivory Coast, Ofwebuanyi was there for 33 years. In Gabon, it was like Bongo the father was there for around 40 years. Same thing with Yedema, the father.
Why don't you say Omar Bongo or Bernard Bongo? If he was feeling good with the French, he was Bernard, and if he was feeling very well with the Middle East, he was Omar Bongo.
Okay, the Omar Bongo, the father, like in Gabon. So Togo, 40 years, Mobutu, maybe around 35 years. So in the light of this, when the African had the opportunity to decide of the framework, democratic frameworks, many of them thought that a presidential term limit was a good thing, you know, to foster democratic changes in the society. It's not like it's going to solve all the ills in the society, but at least, you know, it gives an opportunity to see new blood leading, you know, our countries. The other thing that we need to know for those who are listening to us, yes, George Washington, that was in the beginning of the creation of the United States. And then we had in the 18th century, and then later on, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was going to be there for four terms from 1932 to 1945, then because of what George Washington started and because of the tradition that people saw in the United States politics, one or two terms, then when they saw Franklin Delano Roosevelt being there for four terms, and he died on April 12, 1945, he did not finish his fourth term. And then this is how they decided that they were going to make some amendments, you know, to put some term limits in America. And then this became a part of a political tradition on the world stage. And this is how Africans today are doing what they can in order to foster and then to enforce that presidential term limits, which I support, and by the way, because if somebody wants to do some work, in 4 years, you can do it. Thomas Sankara did it. In less than 10 years, you can do it. Kwame Nkrumah did it. In less than 6 months, or maybe no less than 1 year, you can do that. Murtala in Nigeria did it. So we have examples in Africa of people who did the right thing in a short amount of time. We should not forget that Nelson Mandela was there for only one term when he had the possibility to be there for two terms. And that was a very important symbol.
But would it really be fair for you to give an example of the Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana? Dr. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, the last time I checked, he actually reigned at a time when Africa embraced the one-party state, and there were no clear constitutional term limits. If he wasn't overthrown in 1966, he probably would be still with us.
He's a human being. Maybe he would have died. Maybe after, he would have died, or maybe after. Yes, and it's a very good point that in the aftermath of independence, and sometimes when people talk about those African leaders, I see some people that want to say Nkrumah was a dictator and Ofwe was not. No, all of them, in the aftermath of independence, they thought that a one-party system would be the framework through which they could promote national unity and national reconciliation. Ofwebuanyi did it, Nkrumah did it, and then many other leaders, even though during colonialism, there were multi-party system. So yes, but when I was mentioning Kwame Nkrumah, I just wanted to say that he achieved so much in a short amount of time. That's why I mentioned Kwame Nkrumah. It was not bigger about the presidential term limits.
And you have a point there, definitely. Let me come back to you, David. You talked about, of course, the need for constitutional term limits in a republic. But there are also some other exceptions, David. You could actually be a republic and have a parliamentary system. And if you have a parliamentary system, you could actually be a prime minister for a very, very long time. There are no term limits when it comes to parliamentary system. Helmut Kohl, for example, in Germany, he ruled almost like some African dictators. But in his particular case, and in fairness to him and his country, Germany, he offered himself every 5 years to the electorate. And the electorate chose him to be the chancellor of Germany.
So this is very true. And if I may, let me just go back very briefly to what we've been talking about with, for example, Hugues Boigny and Kwame Nkrumah, the Osagyefo. So we also need to remember their context was also different because they were ruling during the period of the Cold War. So there's also that dynamic when the East and West were really trying to find their patrons on the continent. Now, post 1990, the democracy became the only game in town. And there was this big hope in Africa and around the world that the continent would democratize. So to your point, Shaka, term limits, we shouldn't necessarily conflate term limits with democracy because you can't have democracy, rule of the people, without term limits. You've mentioned the United Kingdom, you've mentioned Germany, Australia, France. A lot of these systems have parliamentary systems of government where the leaders can go on for multiple cycles of rulership, like Angela Merkel in Germany currently. The difference here is these individuals always bring themselves back to the people to seek additional mandates. Secondly, the democratic space, the political playing field is open and even for everybody, for the party in power and also for the opposition. So it's also possible for the opposition to win power. And you saw that with Margaret Thatcher, even after her long period of power, the Labour government was able to come in and, well, there was an internal coup within her party, and eventually the opposition was able to come into power. So it's very important that we don't conflate term limits necessarily with democracy, because we've had term limits, but we've also had leaders that do not respect their constitutions. So anytime their term of office is coming to an end, they'll manipulate the constitution and want to run for multiple additional periods of time. We're seeing this currently in the Ivory Coast, and unfortunately it's happened in Guinea. And this is a particular problem. We also saw this in Zimbabwe, where it was a different context, but we saw Robert Mugabe wanting to extend his influence in office through a surrogate which he appointed, and the military eventually took him out of office. So term limits in and of themselves do not ensure democratic rule. Leaders always have to submit themselves to the will of the people through regular, free, and fair elections.
We should point out, by the way, that in Africa, there are currently some countries which have embraced parliamentary system. We are talking about, for example, Ethiopia. We are talking also about, for example, Mauritius. And Mauritius, in particular, seems to be doing everything that seems to be a beacon of hope for African democracy.
I think that it's not because people adopt a parliamentary system that's why they should not embrace term limits, right? I think that, like I said, and then many researchers said it, it's a good thing. Yes, Angela Merkel, she's still there in Germany, but I think that in a party, it is possible to find somebody else who can do what she's doing. And then that impression of being an indispensable person in a political party or in a state, that too need to be changed. In America, we see traditional term limits, which is a good thing. But at the same time, the senators they are in power for forever. And the example I always like to give is that of Robert Byrd. The late Robert Byrd of West Virginia.
Correct.
He was a senator for 50 years, 50 years. And that's not right. In a country like the United States, I think that they should also think about term limits, you know, at the level of the Congress. So I think that this can give the possibility to renew the political class, to renew the leadership in the society. And it's not because people in Germany seem to be working that democratic system. That's why they're not going to embrace like that term limit. So this is what I think. So this I wanted to add that. Yes, good.
Shaka, if I could also jump in on that point. So there's both positives and negatives in terms of term limits. So, for example, the example the professor just mentioned with Orrin Hatch and also with Joe Biden, who's been in the Senate for close to 47 years now. So also having term limits, one of the advantages with not having term limits, for example, with the Senate, is there's this argument that you need that expertise, Shaka. You need someone who's been in the Senate for a long time because they have the expertise, they have the wisdom of bringing people together. In the context of the United States, the country is very evenly split equally between Republicans and Democrats. If you look at the Senate, it's almost equally split. So the argument for not having term limits is this idea that you get individuals with experience that know how to compromise, that have established these trust networks across the aisle and are able to bring people together. But the disadvantage, again, with that is that you have entrenched interests, and sometimes when someone's been in office too long, they tend to forget the interests of their people. And in our context, for example, in U.S., you have this in the case of the senator from Maine, who's currently facing a significant, challenge to her leadership in that state. So there's both advantages and disadvantages to term limits.
Interesting. Nyaka, what about the fact, for example, that as a senator, yes, you have power, but you can't quite possibly compare the power of a senator to or with the power of a sitting president?
Yes, of course. I agree with you. When you're a senator, you represent the state in the case of the United States. Or some regions like in some other parts of the world. Maybe today we may not have the opportunity to talk about that. In my reflections and then things I've been thinking about, I think that people need to think to renew the political and democratic system. There are many good things in the American democratic system, even though there were some pitfalls since the inception of this country, the fact that African Americans and some other minorities have been ostracized. But the idea of democracy in the 18th century, when Europe was still attached, to monarchy, and David mentioned that passing, and then the idea of constitutional monarchy in England, and then after the Glorious Revolution. So we saw that all those things are positive, but today in the 21st century, we can think about a new democratic system. And then being senator for 50 years, then I have a difficulty to understand that. Be a senator for 47 years, please, Joe Biden, you can find somebody who can do the work. So that, like I said again, people that we need a renewal of political leadership in the society. And then if you stay too long like that, then you're going to become you're going to be corrupt. And that's why many of them are being in the United States, are being in any other parts of the world, then, you know, because they're tied to some special interest and they cannot do the work. So that's why if they are, if one day they want to amend some constitution, be here, or in the case of Ivory Coast, yes, presidential, we can put a presidential term limits in Ivory Coast. We can also say, you know what, if you want to be a lawmaker, you can be there maybe for two or three terms or four terms. And after that, we need some new blood, like in the political elite. So this is what I will be fighting for.
Now, Nyaka, I am not a lawyer, but at least I do know, for example, that a constitution is not carved out of a stone. A constitution is a living document, and therefore can, in fact, be amended at any time.
Yes, and then, yes, and I like what you said, but at the same time, because the constitution is drafted by human beings, and then who have their special interest, we who have their special world views, most of the time, when they do the constitution, even though they say that the constitution are impersonal, you know that most of the time they serve some many interests. In the case of the United States, we know. I will not go to come back and talk about, what I just mentioned when we I was talking about African Americans in this country. In the case of Ivory Coast, there was a constitution in 2000, and then it was, people thought it was like one of the most wonderful constitution in Ivory Coast. But we knew that there were some issues in the constitution, even though people wanted to resolve the issue, they wanted to resolve some problem in the society. For instance, Ufo-Boigny stayed in power for so long. They said, you know what, let's put presidential term limits. Bédié became the successor of Ufo-Boigny, as if we were in a monarchy. Also, you know, they resolved that too in that Article 35. And Mr. Ouattara, who was going from one country to another country and changing citizenship, according to many, they said, you know what, if you want to be a president in Ivory Coast, you have to be an Ivorian, a born Ivorian, of a father and a mother who were also born Ivorian. Ouattara said that this constitution was against him. And then we know what happened, a rebellion, everything. But now, Mr. Ouattara he became president. What did he do? And if you give me 2 minutes, I want to talk about that because it's a very important element for people to understand. What did he do? He put together a committee of experts led by Mr. Professor Uraga Obu, who was in Gbagbo's party, and then who had later on some dissension with Gbagbo. And then in the constitution, they took into account, and Uraga said that Mr. Ouattara's needs or desire or think some of the things he wanted to see in the constitution. The first thing, we have a president and now a prime minister. Back then, now Ouattara said he wanted to have like a vice president. So one thing that he wanted. Number two, the clause related to the nationality, they changed it, that if you want to run for president in Ivory Coast, you have to be exclusively Ivorian. In other words, you can be a citizen of America, a citizen of France, a citizen of Burkina Faso, but and then if you can claim to have the Ivorian citizenship, when you are about to run, then you renounce to the other citizenship, and then you can become the president of Ivory Coast. But the notion of the attachment of the land has been like put aside. So Mr. Ouattara did that, and there are so many other things. So my point is that our constitution to 2015, 2020, that it has been amended, but we cannot say that it is impersonal. It is put together by Mr. Ouattara so that he can serve his interests and then keep power in the hands of the Northerners. I just wanted to talk about that.
I see. Now, David, what about the fact that when somebody becomes a president, that particular individual swears an oath to defend, to protect, and to preserve the constitution that allows that particular individual to assume the office of the president? Isn't it unconstitutional, really, for that particular individual to preside over the changes of that particular document or to benefit from changes from that particular document in order to serve another term in office?
I think that becomes very problematic. And this goes to a point, Shaka, you had raised earlier about amending constitutions. The US Constitution, for example, has been amended 27 times in 400 years. That is four centuries. They've only had 27 amendments.
Right.
You look at the US Constitution, you also realize the threshold to amend the Constitution is very high. It's not easy just to go and amend the Constitution. So that's another constitutional safeguard. The third element of alluding to what you'd mentioned, Chaka, is this idea of the letter and the spirit of the Constitution. So those are two different elements which are related, but are also very similar and important in the context that as much as you're the executive and you can coalesce different coalitions to change your Constitution as many times as you want, but the spirit of the Constitution is against that, which is part of these safeguards we have in the Constitution to say that, for example, in the United States, you need an absolute majority. You need three-fourths of the states, three-fourths of the members of Congress. That's a very high threshold. And what that tells you is that we want to make the process of amending the Constitution very difficult so that you don't have an individual who wants to stay in power forever. If I may add, Shaka, if you take the example, for example, of Egypt, Mubarak with the National Democratic Party was in power and played around with the Constitution, kept having elections, but elections in Egypt really didn't mean anything under Hosni Mubarak.
They were really selections, someone might say, not elections.
Exactly. So in that case, it really shows this idea that even if the Constitution says you have term limits, but here you have an individual who's perfected the process of manipulating the Constitution. And Shaka, this then leads us to the broader problem that we are facing in places like Mali and Zimbabwe, where because the executive, the presidents, don't respect the Constitution, they keep amending the Constitution to stay in power, then you have extra constitutional means, extra legal means to remove them from power. We saw this in Zimbabwe with the recent military intervention there to remove Mugabe. And we're now seeing this similar problem in Mali with the current impasse after the removal President
Keita.
Correct. Because then you have the military intervening, and this creates a very uncomfortable position because the military don't always abide to what they promise when they come into power. They usually turn into being repressive, putting down the rights of the individuals, because militaries are not set up to govern. Militaries are set up to kill, to destroy. They are not set up to run governments.
Very, very, very interesting, Inyaka. I think that David's point is, well made. And my question to you, Inyaka, is, yes, the military is not, for example, recognized by the international community when it seizes power. It is not recognized. People or governments do not get into the business of doing business with military leaders. This is something that has been agreed upon by the African Union and the international community. Any particular reason, for example, why the African Union and the international community do not also agree, do not also reach a point where they say, if you are an incumbent president, you have stolen an election. In other words, you have had an election whose results do not reflect the will of the people, but the will of those individuals who count the votes, who you have previously appointed to the Electoral Commission, and that the international, for example, and domestic observers who monitored those elections say those elections were neither fair nor free nor credible. We are not going to do business with you as usual. Also, if, for example, an incumbent shifts the constitutional political goalposts on his watch, why doesn't the international community apply the same measures, the same policy, the same attitude? They don't want to do business with a soldier who has seized power unconstitutionally.
This is the question is a profound, it's a deep question, and it's a serious question. I commend you for it. We will not have time to go to talk about that, but I'm going to try and answer. And then, first of all, I would like to say something as to distance myself a little bit from what David said. When he's talking about Mali, it looks like he's falling the trap of, you know, the international media presenting what happened in Mali as a coup d'etat. The first thing is that it's not, if we think that it is a coup d'etat, we may have a simplistic way of analyzing. So when we are analyzing African politics, you know, we have to be cautious. There are many good things, like in the European societies, that we can claim, but we cannot just say, for instance, like in Mali, it's just a coup d'etat. No, it is a people's movement, a people's power movement.
Time is not our best ally. We'll go for a break, and when we come back, we shall continue with our conversation.
Is about more than just sitting here and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure their voices are heard.
Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Our distinguished guests are David Onserio Monda, professor of political science at the City University of New York, and Nyaka Lagoke, Assistant Professor of History and Pan-African Studies at Lincoln University. Let me go back really to the topic of the day, which is constitutional term limits. We're talking about situations here where some observers have suggested that if you look at the case of Alassane Ouattara in the Ivory Coast, his supporters are saying, here is a man who has unique leadership qualities that the country cannot do without. We had the same argument in Uganda, for example, when it came to removing the term limits, that Ugandan president Yoweri Museveni was uniquely gifted to such an extent that the country could not possibly do without his leadership skills.
No, so it's a fallacy. And then the real reason why Mr. Ouattara is seen by his supporters as somebody who is uniquely gifted to rule over Ivory Coast is because they think that with him, the power can stay in the hands of the Northerners. If you want to analyze Ivory Coast politics from the ethnocentric perspective. And yes, Mr. Ouattara has some qualities as a leader, but he's not an indispensable person. And then Ivory Coast survived Oufuette Boigny, who was there for 33 years, and then who thought he was an indispensable person. This is not how we can see things. And in the beginning of this show, I remember when we were talking about term limits, and I even said that even at the level of Congress, at the level of the parliament, people need to think about renewing the political elite. So if Mr. Ouattara wanted to find some people in his party to replace him, he could have done it. In the beginning, he said that he had trained people. And then like 2 weeks ago, and he said like in something that was so, and people were even laughing at him. Oh yes, do you know how much time it took me to train Amadou Gon Coulibaly? You cannot just train somebody like in 2 months or 3 months. That's a joke.
The late Coulibaly.
The late Coulibaly. So it means that you are in 50 years, then you train only one person. And that's one of the things.
Nyaka, wait a minute. You allege here that Alassane Ouattara wants to stay in power simply because, in turn, we are talking about the northern part of Ivory Coast holding on to power. But what about his former political ally, Guillaume Soro, a former prime minister? He's also from the north.
Guillaume Soro is 48 now. So Guillaume Soro supported Ouattara. Then he assumed the leadership of the rebellion. And then Guillaume Soro rightfully thought that he could be the successor of Mr. Ouattara. And then he thinks that he has the qualities and the abilities to be the successor, but Mr. Ouattara did not want him. And then because either Mr. Ouattara wanted the late Amadou Gon Coulibaly, or Mr. Ouattara wanted his brother that everyone calls in Ivory Coast photocopy. They're not twins, but they look alike. And then when we changed the constitution, and then in 2015, if you want to run for a president, it was like in the United States or in Ghana, you have to have a running mate. But when recently in 2020, there was some amendment in the constitution. This time, if you want, you will run as an individual. And then when you are elected, then you choose the person you want as your vice president. So then people were suspecting Mr. Ouattara to do this, that scheme, because he wanted, you know, to position his brother that was going to be selected by the late Gon Coulibaly, if the late Gon Coulibaly could become the president of the country. So with all those things, yes, Soro Guillaume, not that he's a great leader, but Soro Guillaume could have represented Ouattara's party and some other ones. And Ouattara is doing that for his own selfish interest. And recently, what did he say? Oh, I prefer to die in power rather than be in prison. So
what about Amadou Coulibaly? Was he a victim of divine intervention, or was it arranged by someone for him
people, many people in Ivory Coast were saying, as many some, that yes, Ouattara put Gon Coulibaly there, and then he wanted Gon Coulibaly to die before the election. I could not agree with that.
But this is this is a man who had a heart transplant.
In 2014. This one say he had a heart transplant, but this is what I know. I don't think that Ouattara said that he was going to choose Gon Coulibaly because he knew that Gon was going to die before the election. I don't have any evidence. When I don't know something, I don't talk about it. But what about
circumstantial evidence?
Now, this one say what I suspect is that he knew that the guy didn't have a long life, that he thought that the guy could become the president. That was plan B. And then if the guy becomes the president...
And there was no plan C?
No, there was no plan C. And then...
Plan C, in fact, was Ouattara.
No. Ouattara is not even... Ouattara is plan A. It's plan A and plan Z. It's about him in the beginning. It is because he was forced by the United States, by France, Macron, and the international community. That's why he accepted to choose Gon Coulibaly. But he was hoping that when Gon becomes president, that his brother could become the vice president. So that was the plan.
But the divine intervention
exposed his plan. And then he was now therefore obliged to come out and say that he's going to run in the name of stability and progress and all those things. Yes.
So basically, when we look at Ivory Coast politics, the only constant is Alassane Ouattara.
The only what?
constant.
Yes. This is what he wants to see.
Very interesting. Let me ask you this question, David. You know, there are people who say some of these long-serving incumbent presidents, for example, you can talk about, for example, the president of Equatorial Guinea. Equatorial Guinea, this is a man that came to power in 1979. He is the world's longest ruler. He's still going strong. When you talk about a man of Equatorial Guinea, you talk about some other specific individuals in the continent, some people who have followed them very closely will tell you these are people who do not feel safe outside of State House with their families. But when you think about a man sincerely like Alassane Ouattara, PhD in economics from one of the most prominent universities, not only in the United States, but in the world, University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School of Business. You have a man who was the number two deputy director of the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. for years. What does he really want? What is he looking for? When you look at a man like Alpha Conde of the Republic of Guinea, he was a professor at one of France's most prestigious universities for a very long time, University of Paris. In fact, I think Lisbon. He's not poor. He is an intellectual heavyweight. He has had the opportunity to serve his people, and yet wants to hang on as if there is no any other soul in that country who could be a leader. What do you honestly think motivates some of these individuals to do what they are doing?
I think for Obiang Nguema in Equatorial Guinea, the issue is
Theodore Obiang Basog.
Correct. He has he's presiding over what you call a rentier state. Essentially, the country has a lot of oil wealth, and over the years, you've established this patrimonial system of patronage, this neo-patrimonial system. So the president's not really ruling with the interests of the state, but the state has been hijacked by a bunch of elites. And the problem is, as the years go on, it becomes more difficult for change to be effected in Equatorial Guinea. In many of these instances where you have long-time serving leaders, look at the case of Saddam Hussein, look at the case of Mubarak, the same thing will happen in Equatorial Guinea. Either the leader is assassinated or they die in office, but it's usually very violent, that turnover, because there's no space for a transition. In the case of Ivory Coast, I think that here's where we have the disconnect between Western elite education and actual conditions on the ground in Africa. We've had a lot of our leaders, Nkrumah, Jomo Kenyatta, Mugabe, educated at some of the most sophisticated Western institutions. Unfortunately, when they come on the ground in Africa, they are mixed in with our patronage system, which isn't in and of itself bad. But I think they fail to establish institutions that will allow the country to move on after they have left power. And I think this is part of the problem in Ivory Coast with the legacy of Ifueboigny. This is part of the problem in Equatorial Guinea, because you have to entrench institutions, and term limits are part of that process, because it allows for the country to breathe, it allows for new ideas, and it allows for those clientelist patronage network to be broken down. So this is why term limits that we're talking about today is so important. you need to be able to have different individuals with different skills coming in. So, and also in conclusion, I think Obama said it best when he addressed the African Union. If you're a leader in Africa and you say that you're staying in power because there's nobody else that can take over power in the country will implode. For example, what's happening in Uganda or with Kagame in Rwanda, then you have failed as a leader, because part of the process of being a leader is to be able to nurture and develop individuals to take over from you, because human beings are not immortal. So I think in a lot of these contexts, part of the bigger, broader problem is lack of development of strong institutions and lack of the leadership from those in power to create transitional spaces for new people to take over the country and for institutions to allow for this turnover of the leadership. I think that's one of the big problems we have on the African continent.
But what about, how do you explain, for example, some of the few individuals that have actually done what you criticized and yet have had the courage and wisdom to allow transition under someone else? Your own country, the Republic of Kenya. You had, for example, Daniel Toroitich Arap Moi. He was in power for 24 years. You had in Malawi, you had Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda, a man who held an election 1993 to find out whether people were still interested in one-party state or they wanted a multi-party system. The people who wanted a multi-party system won that election. The following year, 1994, he stood for election, even though he had actually previously been life president, was defeated by Bakiri Muluzi. He considered defeat with grace, and there was smooth transition. You have had people like Tanzanian founding president, Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere. You had Senegal. You had Leopold Seda Senghor, a man who came close to winning, in fact, a Nobel laureate for literature. The man who was one of the co-founders of this idea of negritude. You have had several other individuals on the continent who have served their countries, but at the end of the day, they put everything aside and made sure that they put the interests of the country above those of their political parties or their individual selfishness and greed.
So you raise an interesting point. And I think this segues back to a lot of what we've been talking about, entrenching institutions and respect for term limits and constitutions, because you will not always have someone as charismatic and able to concede as a Kenneth Kaunda. You'll not have an authoritarian who eventually decides to concede like Arap Moi. You'll not have someone like Seda Senghor. This is why the institutions are very important. You're going to have individuals like Donald Trump who will severely test democratic institutions. And we are facing a similar problem in the United States this coming November. So we've been at this game even in the United States for 400 years. But still, this is why institutions are extremely, extremely important. The executive can significantly challenge these democratic institutions. I think that the other point, Shaka, is that it's extremely important to understand also in the context of Daniel Arap Moi and Kenneth Kaunda that as much as these individuals conceded power, Kaunda didn't expect to lose the election in 1991.
Yeah, but you give him credit for an African strong man to carry out an election which he can actually lose, because it was almost standard.
I give him credit for that, Shaka,
at that time. that no strong man conducted an election that they could lose.
Correct, but I will not congratulate a leader for doing what he's supposed to do anyway, because this is what should be happening, right? So, and if you look at the case of Daniel Arap Moi in Kenya, there was significant international, local, and civil society pressure. This was not just handed to Kenyans on a plate. A lot of people sacrificed their lives. People were detained. People were tortured. So this, you know, he didn't just wake up one day and decide, oh, suddenly I'm going to hand over power. The development of institutions, civil society pressure is extremely important.
But you also have to give credit, of course, to the individual of Samuel Kivuitu, the man who presided over that election.
I give credit to him, although his critics have really questioned his bungling of other elections after that. So he's also a very highly controversial individual.
But what about Nyaka? Is it possible that we are going to Africa is likely to reach that kind of level or point that is being advocated by your fellow panelist, David, unless and until you actually have a population that is socially and politically conscious, socially and politically aware of their rights, and that in fact they are citizens because they owe allegiance to the state, which means they have constitutional rights. Others might in fact call them inalienable rights, or even birthrights for that matter. Is it possible that you can get to that kind of level, really, of politics that we are talking about, without sincerely the main stakeholders being socially and politically conscious?
David said many good things, and he's of course, I agree, he's right, that, you know, we cannot count on the free will of some enlightened leaders to do the right thing. And then people need to fight for a stronger institution, the community. That's point number one. Point number two, it is what you just said. People need to be socially and politically conscious in the society, because people can have the most beautiful constitution in the world, and then a leader can come, and then and he can change, you know, he can try and change the rules of the game. He mentioned Donald Trump, but when George W. Bush, when he was supposed to leave power, I saw in his last speech, the guy was weeping. When they asked Bill Clinton one day, what is the thing that is missing the most, they say, hey, hail to the chief. You know, so even in America, where, you know, you can see strong institutions and democracy working the way it is working, even though there are many pitfalls, people, it's difficult for leaders to just leave power like that. So David has a good point. Now, I'm hopeful because things are changing. Listen. In the aftermath of independence, we had leaders who were in power for one party system. We spoke about that. Longer rules, 33 years, 35. And then later on, we have a series of military leaders who were in power in Africa, you know, in the 70s. When you see a picture of the African head of state, you will see many leaders, many military leaders in power. And later on, in 1990, when we saw that Africans were claiming the return to multi-party system with the organization of those national conferences, people came together with some new rules, you know, for the democratic game in Africa. And now today, in 2018, the Afrobarometer organized like a survey, three-quarters of Africans that believe in term limit. And then even though there are some people like Kagame and Ouattara, but we saw that it is working. Liberia, Sierra Leone, and then in Tanzania, in some other countries. Ghana, thank you, Ghana. It is working. Even Rawlings, that David was talking about, after 20 years of military rule, he left the power to the civilians. So this is also a credit to Rawlings, a military guy, and then who stabilized Ghana, because after the overthrow of Nkrumah, Ghana experienced 7 coups d'etat in Ghana. somebody came to try and restore stability, even though there were some human rights abuses. So yes, the people have to be conscious, and the people have to take into the hands, the need, you know, for a better democratic society. And that's the only way they can keep those presidents in check. So that will be my answer.
Final question, David. What about elections, which some pundits in fact characterize as elections, especially because when they are held under an incumbent president on the African continent, you sometimes, by the way, even know the results of that particular election before even the date of the event when actually people go and cast their vote. Are these elections really meant for the primary stakeholders in those countries, or are they in fact meant for the development partners so that some of these countries can continue receiving aid?
I think definitely the latter of your statements, for the development partners, for a system to appear to be democratic, right? Yet, in actual fact, the opposition is not being given a level playing field with the incumbent. There's a muzzling of the free media. There's a lack of openness in terms of recruitment. The independent electoral commissions are not independent. But Shaka, to your earlier point also, that incumbents generally have an advantage anywhere in the world. If you look at the statistics, even in this country, 67% of the incumbent presidents end up winning elections. So incumbency in and of itself doesn't necessarily delegitimize the success of whoever's in office. However, the important part is, are the institutions transparent? Are they open? Is there a level playing field such that if the president is being challenged by an opposition party candidate, there's an equal chance that there can be a transition. There can be a change of power. Because having elections in and of themselves doesn't necessarily mean you have a democratic system. But yep. Part of the issue is the term limits, I think, is one element of restricting the abuse of power. I think having open and democratic systems, having development of the civil society. And I have to go back again to that question of the military. The military has to remain in the barracks. We need to allow our continent to grow its germane democratic institutions. Politicians and people power needs to be able to sort out people problems. The military really has no business delving in politics.
Thank you.
Chaka. Okay.
Well, on that note, gentlemen, okay. It was really a pleasure having this sort of interesting discussion. Thank you, and we look forward, of course, to having you again.
Thank you so much, Jacob, for the privilege of being on your show.
No, you're most welcome, my brothers. On that note, our distinguished guests are David Onsario Monda and Nyaka Lagoke. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. Get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.